Accession number 34596.
Reel 1.
Mr. John de Hoop, Reel 1. John, could you tell me where and when you were born, please?
London, Hammersmith, 1924.
And a little bit about your family background?
My father was Dutch, and he came to England before the First World War, and he was a professional violinist. I lived my early years in London because my father's engagements were always central London, so we always lived generally towards the centre. In fact, the last few years before I went in the forces, we had accommodation not far from Victoria Station, so quite central.
Your father, you said he was a professional violinist. What type of engagements would he have?
Primarily they were with various orchestras. He seemed to move quite a lot. But before the First World War, when he was sort of in his early 20s, because I was born quite late on in his life, he played a lot in Europe and also went to America, and I think he played in the Vienna Philharmonic for some time in the 1900s. So he had an interesting life, but musicians often have a... Bye.
Sorry, I hit the pause button on there, so...
Yes. Yes, he travelled quite a bit when he was young, but when he came to England, which I suppose must have been... Yes, it must have been just before the First World War started. I can remember him telling me about when the war started. He was sitting on the bus with a fellow Dutchman in London, and they were speaking Dutch, and my dad noticed some rather peculiar looks from other people. To them, Dutch and German probably sounded the same. And my father had to say to his friend, "Speak in English, because we get in trouble." So that was my dad. We didn't have very much in common, but as I say, he was well in his 40s when I was born.
And where were you educated?
Again, according to moving around from one address to another, it was various basic schools, and I finished up in what's classified as a grammar school, which was not very far from, Buckingham Palace, actually. And, of course, when the Second World War started, I was an evacuee.
Can I ask a little bit, before we talk about you being evacuated, were you aware of the sort of situation in Europe in the sort of late 1930s?
Yes, I think I was, because I think being an only one, I was a great reader, and I read all kinds of things and papers and reading about the political situation. And I can particularly remember the big debate at school at the time of Munich and whether we'd done the right thing in appeasing Hitler.
And were there any sort of preparations at that time? I'm thinking at the time of Munich, so prior to the outbreak of war, you know, for a potential war coming at all at that stage.
Well, as regards to schooling, there was talk that there would be an evacuation of children, and I think we were given instructions as to what we were to do if the balloon went up. In our case, it was pack a suitcase and come down to Victoria Station by a certain time, where you would be entrained somewhere, didn't know where, but somewhere.
And is that what occurred, obviously, when war broke out?
Yes, I think about a day before the war actually was officially declared, the evacuation came about, and we went down to the station, and all the parents were there, sort of tearful, waving off the youngsters. We got into this train, and off we went, and suddenly at one station we were told all to get out, and that was Hayward Heath station. So I'm not all that far from where I was.
And where were you billeted when you were evacuated?
Well, the majority of the school went to Hand Cross. Some were put up in houses, of course, and some of them were put up in a big house called Nyman's, which is still there, and it's a National Trust property. It was then owned by Colonel Messel. And some of the older boys, including me, were put up in a big house at Ardingly, and we were there until March 40, when the army took over the house, and we moved down to Hand Cross with the rest of the school.
And did your... When you were with the school, were teachers evacuated with you at that point?
Some. Well, one of the big problems was that depended on which teachers came as to what subjects you were taking. And the other problem was that you were sharing the school with the village school, which meant you did probably only half a day. And in our case, I think we were limited to English and maths, basically. So that when my father came down in about April or May of 1940 and saw the education I was getting, he said, well, you're wasting your time here. And, of course, the phony war was still on. We had no bombing or anything. So I came back home semi-educated, which I've remained ever since. And I was home in time for when the Blitzes started.
So when you came home, did you carry on with your education? Or
No, that was it. I started work up in the city, going on a bicycle, which was the easiest way to get there. And I suppose I would then be 15 or so. So, yes, I never completed my education.
So at that stage, did you think that there was a likelihood that you would be involved in the war in some way?
Oh, yes, I think I was very keen on the idea of being in the forces. And, in fact, it wasn't long when I was back home in London that I joined the Home Guard, and I was a sort of private pike of Dad's army, really. And then, after a little while, I used to spend my time on duty at Admiralty Arch. I then decided I think I wanted to go into flying. So I then transferred to the Air Training Corps, which is what I was on then.
Can I ask about that little period with the Home Guard? You mentioned that you were like the private pike at Dad's Army. Was it actually like that, or was it a little bit more organised?
It was very much like Dad's Army got it very well. In fact, our platoon commander was a bank manager too, as it happened. And we had two platoons. We were in Carlton House Terrace. We had an area there. And the other platoon consisted of gentlemen from the House of Lords who kept very much to themselves. And the plebs, we were in the other group.
What kind of commitment did you have to give to the Home Guard at that stage?
Well, it was primarily guard duties in the evening, and occasional courses at weekends. But it was very amateurish when I look back on it. God preserve us if the Germans had ever landed. But there was enthusiasm there, and there was that dividing line between the old sweats from the First World War with their medals and tabs, and us keen lads who were, you know, wasn't it nice to have a rifle of your own which you kept clean and shining?
Did you have an opportunity to go on a range anywhere with the rifle at all?
Oh yes, we went on ranges. Yes. Didn't get anything more serious than that, you know, nothing like Bren guns or things, but just the rifles. Yes.
And I take it that you would drill as well, would you? With the...
We had some drill, not much, but not very much. No.
So, were the majority of time that you did, would it then be guard duties or just general kind of duties?
Yes. Admiralty Arch then had a big concrete pillbox, and that was where we were on. So I experienced London at all hours of day and night, which was very interesting, seeing people who were going to work at 2 o'clock in the morning, and also it was a different way of life, you know.
And would you fit that around your work?
Yes.
What were you doing? What were you employed as at that stage?
Well, I was just doing general clerical work in the city. As I say, I had no qualifications, and as far as I was concerned, I was just marking time until I went in the forces.
You mentioned, obviously, that at that period the Blitz started. Do you have any memories of that, obviously, how that started and how it progressed?
Yes, we had a fair number of bombs in the area where I lived. There was a big block of flats completed just before the war, Dolphin Square, which had quite deep areas underneath, and we used to go over there with our blankets and spend the nights there. I had a cousin lived in the next street to me. He was killed in one of the earlier raids. So yes, I saw quite a lot of. I felt the experience of a lot of bombers being dropped on me. But I had it in mind that perhaps in the near future I could return the compliment.
I take it that that period, though, it was quite intense. The raids was on London. Was it every night or?
Practically every night, I would think from about August, September, right through until beginning of 1940. Certainly for quite a few months. Then we had a spell gap, and then heavy raids in May of 41. And then, of course, when the invasion of Russia. It quietened down. From then on, we only had sporadic raids.
So was it a case then, obviously, you would spend most of your nights in the shelter during that early intense period?
Yes, unless I was on duty in the Home Guard. I had to split my time.
And that, when you were in the Home Guard, would you take shelter? I mean, you mentioned you had a pillbox.
Yes, we had a pillbox.
But was that taken as a shelter?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there much damage in that sort of area around Admiralty Arch at all?
Not a great deal, actually. I think the Houses of Parliament had one or two bombs on it. I think the Abbey escaped. No, they didn't do too badly there.
You mentioned, obviously, that you went into the Air Training Corps and that you had an interest in potentially flying. Was the motivation purely that issue of being underneath the bombing, or had you an interest in flying generally?
Oh, an interest in flying, because After all, before the war, it was a limited few people who had the opportunity of flying, and here suddenly was an opportunity to fly and actually be paid to fly.
Where was the Air Training Corps based?
It was based in Westminster. In fact, it wasn't far from the Ritz Hotel. Arlington Street, I think, is one side of the Ritz Hotel. And there were some big houses down there. And one of those was taken over by Air Training Corps. And that's where we did our training.
And what form did that sort of training take at that for that? Because it's quite an early stage, isn't it, really, in training to fly, really. What were they teaching you youngsters to do?
It was primarily foot drill, a lot of PT, and some talks about flying generally.
So it was kind of a sort of general induction, was it, into the whole flying world?
Sure.
Did you then have to volunteer for aircrew?
Yes. All aircrew were volunteers. And again, this was another advantage. If you didn't particularly want to go in, say, to the Army, or maybe the Navy, if you waited till you were conscripted, you could say what you'd like to go into. It doesn't mean to say you got there. But if you said, I would go for aircrew, that was there were only volunteers. And once you'd passed the medical things, you were aircrew.
And was it the case that, obviously, having been a member of the Air Training Corps, that was helpful to pursuing that course?
Well, I think it was considered a little bit of a plus, but primarily it was more a question of, were you physically fit, because you had two medicals, the ordinary medical and then an aircrew medical. And I seem to remember we did also have a written exam of some sort, I seem to recall.
How did those two medicals differ then? What's the difference between sort of the sort of basic medical and the aircrew? Are there specific other things that they're looking for?
Well, the only one thing that I can remember was blowing up the mercury, which you had to blow up and hold for a certain period of time. That was one of the big things, and interestingly enough, because in those days, people smoked a lot, and a lot of smokers started quite early. But there were quite a number of the chaps who coming along to the aircrew medical who were particularly irritable because they'd been not smoking for about 2 months because they knew they had to pass this dreaded test of blowing up the mercury. That was one particular thing I recall. But obviously, your medical standard had to be that bit higher than the other two services.
Did they pay attention to eyes and ears as well? Was that something that was...
Yes, they did. Well, very much so. And, of course, you had a night vision test. You sat in a chair and there was a screen in front of you and various... pictures and things came up. You had a clip put on here so you couldn't lean forward to see it closer up at hand, cheating as it were, and then you had to describe what you could see. And in fact, I failed night vision tests, which meant anyway, whatever category I thought I might like to be in, that was very limited. Couldn't be a pilot for a start, couldn't be an air gunner. Although, surprisingly enough, when you trained as a wireless op, you also did an air gunnery course, but despite that.
So was it the case at that stage then, did you want to be a pilot?
Well, it was... from my memory, I think it was... I'm not sure that I did. I really just thought I wanted to fly. And I did think, because I'm talking about then 1942, thinking to myself, if I train for a pilot or navigator, it's a long course, the war might be over. And I didn't want to miss out the action. Such is the foolishness of youth. So, anyway, having failed the night vision test, eventually then you come before a board of very elderly chaps with lots of rings around their cuffs, and they ask you what category you would like to be. And I said air gunner, because that was the shortest course. And after a little discussion, they said, I think you could do a little more than that. There's a vision possibility of a problem. A wireless operator, I think, would be best. So I thought, well, if that's what it is, I'll go for that. That's how I became wireless operator.
And was there a wait between that point of you volunteering and having the sort of initial selection stage and actually being called up?
Yes, I think... I had all this took place about the autumn of 42. I was 18 in December, and I was called up on what seemed a very appropriate date, 1st of April, 43.
Where were you called up to?
Where was I called up to? Well, as I was living with my family, because in Westminster, all I had to do was to take my suitcase and walk down to the bus stop and catch the bus to St John's Wood.
And what was St John's Wood?
St John's Wood was an aircrew receiving centre, and where you were put up into blocks of flats which had been built and completed just when the war started. So they were taken over by the Air Ministry, and that's where we were all piled into. And having made it clear to us that we were the cream of the country, being aircrew, we went for food down to the London Zoo, which they probably thought was appropriate. Mark, you, there were no animals there. I think they'd all left because they couldn't stand the food. But, you know, and that's that was where we were kitted out. We went to Lord's Cricket Ground, I think, was the place that all the kit was kept. And from there, we went on then to ITW for square bashing.
So with that first period of time when you were at St John's Wood, how long were you there? And did you sort of receive sort of an induction into the RAF? Would that be right to think?
Well, an induction into the extent of going on one day, one, two parades. But there were limited areas, so we couldn't do much there. And it was ITW, which was, I think, probably about a month or so, perhaps less than a month, because ITW was where you really started and where you marched around saluting anything that moved.
So where was your ITW?
ITW was in Shropshire, at Bridge North. Which was a very agreeable place. Like most youngsters, I hadn't travelled much as a child, and then we went on holidays. It was always on a train. It was usually the South Coast, so you know, Shropshire was really sort of getting into the bits of empire almost. And And then, of course, from ITW, we were all split up according to your categories. Pilots, navigators and bomb aimers mostly went to North America, South Africa. And wireless operators and air gunners did their, started to do their training here in the UK.
Can I ask about the ITW though again? What's that sort of, you said you were there for about a month. What was the sort of process here? What was the kind of sequence of instruction you received there?
It was mostly marching about, polishing your buttons, and making sure that your billet was absolutely apple pie order. And it doesn't matter how polished it was, and the old lino used to be polished by somebody sitting on one of the blankets, and we'd pull him from one end to the other. And when the sergeant came in, he usually made some very uncomplimentary remarks comparing what we had done with the toilets. But
is it the case with that, though, that you can't get it right at that stage? You will always, it will always never be good enough during any
time. That's certainly my feeling at the time, yes.
And who were the instructors at that stage?
Well, they were all general duties, NCOs, square bashing. It was all square bashing stuff.
And how were you treated at that early stage of your training?
Difficult to say, really. I think some of the NCOs who were regulars made it very clear they didn't like the idea that we, finishing our training, were going to finish up with stripes, which took them 20 years to do. And some of them did rather take it out on us with that attitude.
And how did that manifest itself? Was it just...
Well, you know, because you couldn't do anything right or whatever you thought was right. You know, you spent ages on boots and you could see your face in them and they were still...
And where were you accommodated at RAF Frischnow? And where were you accommodated at Frischnow?
Well, I think to remember they were huts of a sort. I think they were ordinary wooden huts. They weren't the Nissen huts. And quite a lot of us piled in. I can't remember now whether we were in tiered bunks. I don't think we were, actually. But... I don't remember too much about the accommodation.